This episode has been recorded by Janine Preston for Life is a Beach.
Joe was telling us last week about his journey from the start to the finish of his career, but we never got to finish. We started when he was zero, back in the early 70s, late 60s, when he started his career as a builder and ended up retiring and is now with me in the studio as a retiree. So just to let you guys know that entrepreneurs do in fact retire. They do have an opportunity to retire. They do have an opportunity to put their feet up and enjoy their great-grandchildren, which I know he has a great-grandson who just brings such joy to his life. One of the good things about this show is we talk about small business and, of course, big dreams. And it's hashtag small startups, big dreams. And it's all about entrepreneurs. And today's show is about particularly that. We're talking to Joe. Joe, but we have to go back a little. So let's go right back to when you met your wife. How's that?
Oh, good morning, Janine, and thank you for having me. I met Sheila way back in 1966 out in Sasselburg. She was visiting her grandma, and it so happened that there was a wedding in on that weekend. I went to the wedding because the person who was getting married was my colleague at work, and she, out of curiosity of watching weddings, she popped in, and my eye caught her.
She didn't catch, you caught her eye.
My eye caught her. While she was trying to watch the bride and the bridegroom, I saw her and my eye just stayed on her and I said, that one. And it ended up until today.
And how old were you when you met?
I think when we met I was 22, 23 thereabouts.
So 22, 23 is a good age, huh?
Yeah.
And you got married how long afterwards?
We got married in 1970.
You got married in 1970, and how old were you then?
I think then I was around 26, if my calculations are still right.
If your calculations are correct. But now tell me something. Well, how long was it before you decided to have kids?
We got our first kid in 1969. We slipped up.
I was going to say, oops. But you know what? They're all grown up. It gave you an opportunity. You talked about becoming a counselor.
Yes, I became a counselor by chance, really. And what was happening was, last time I told you the escapades I had with the...
With those guys staying over.
Those guys staying over.
And they stayed with you for almost a week while you were selling newspapers.
Correct. And thereafter, when these guys left, then I noticed, Sheila noticed that someone was watching the house. And it started from there, the house being watched. And from there, the special branch got onto me.
The special branch?
You know the special branch?
Yes. They were the specially mean ones.
Those were the police that would follow you up and say you are a terrorist or you are a communist or you are a member of the ANC, member of whatever political party which was banned. Now, those are the people that they kind of chased me around. And now, I was active in church, you know, with all the youth and what have you. And I realized these people were just on my case. So 1977, when the then government introduced the community councils, I saw that as a chance to join the community councils. And then they started chasing after me. Then I went to the then administration board director, by the name of Knutze, if I remember well. And I said to him, listen, the government has established a community council. And I have decided to join and become a counselor. Now, here are the police chasing me. And they say I am a troublemaker and what have you.
Joe, you don't look like a troublemaker. You look like a granddad. You look like a granddad.
At the time, then after I'd spoken that, I mean, I had reported now, and the appointed, authorities were happy that I had joined into their policy. So as a counselor, I sort of got a sanctuary, if you want to call it that. The director then called the minister. Then it was who called me, Mildred, I think. He said, listen, get your boys off my counselors. This guy is a counselor for Zambela. This is his ward and what have you and what have you and what have you. And ever since, they got off my case.
That is a scary moment. I'm sure it was for you as well. So nice to have him back in the studio, and it's taken us back in time to that time when, for half the world is really a scary place, and for the other half, it wasn't as scary.
Yeah, after I had reported to the director of the then Vaal Triangle, then the hounding stopped. Because they said, look, this guy is towing the line, he's doing what we want and whatever. How can you say he's a communist? You know? I mean, I dodged under that, and I was conveniently off their radar.
And you were still obviously in the Vaal area?
I was still
point.
In the Vaal. I was working for the Heaven Foundation at the time.
So you had a regular job?
Yeah, I had a regular job, and I was a part-time counselor. But I would be released, you know, each time there's a meeting, I go to the meeting, my company would say, go, and that's it.
And what was your role as a counselor? In other words, in that particular time period, your hands were obviously tied, pretty much not like it is at the moment, but in those days, I'm sure you were almost told what to do.
The truth is, I was told, as I was part of the ones that were told, because the community councils were meant to serve what they called black municipalities in theory, and there was, at the time, we had municipalities which were white. You had white councillors that decided on the fate of that particular town. So the introduction of community councils was really a parallel wagon, if you want to call it that.
So it was more, you were a messenger. Would you see yourself as they gave you a message to distribute and you distributed the message because you were respected in your community? Is that kind of how it was?
No, what they were doing is they wanted us to run our affairs, black affairs, for black people.
Okay.
Like before then, they had advisory councils where whites would sit and they would get people in the township, you know, prominent people who would come and sit with them and advise them on what black people wanted and stuff like that. So from advisory councils came the community councils. But I must say, in the community councils, I learned quite a bit, because what they were doing is they were duplicating precisely what the municipalities were doing. As a councillor, you came to know that, you know, to arrive at the budget, how they arrive at that budget. You know, there's a lot of civic matters that I learned, which I didn't know, which unfortunately the current councillors have missed out on. That's why they're messing up like this.
And they've never learned from people like yourself who were
learned.
So involved.
Yeah.
And all they have to do is turn around and
exactly.
Talk to you.
Because there would be minutes, and you'd read the minutes, you'd be able to go back and say, no, this is not on, I didn't say that. You know, put up your story and stuff like that. So, and whilst we were doing that on comparison with what the white councils were doing. And like I'm saying, they said this was a parallel wagon. And that was what they were doing because they had also developed the homelands. To say the homelands must run black affairs of people in the homelands. And we in urban areas would be able to run black affairs for our black people who were then temporary sojourners in the townships.
Okay, that's interesting. And I think a lot of the way that they are running now is because they don't connect to their communities, be they white or black or coloured. It really doesn't matter. They need to connect with their community. They're serving a community.
There I learned quite a bit of tricks. I mean, this Knutse guy would teach us, you know, precisely just how they build the townships. You know, I mean, you'd think government would give money from Pretoria. Yes, they did. But in the most, the townships were built by ourselves without us knowing. What the chief director would do is he would get his team together, his technical team, quantity surveyors, you know, your architects and all your technical worst names, put them together and say, listen guys, we want to put up a township of 5,000 houses. And one would come up with a drawing and say, here's the four-roomed house, basic thing, here's a toilet, and this is how the services are. And they would work that out, come up with a figure, and once they have a figure to say maybe this is going to cost 20 million, then the municipality, the then director of what's name would go to the building society and say to the building society, we want to borrow money to build, we want to borrow 20 million from you over 20 years. Now this is what the current crop is not doing. Borrow 20 million, take the 20 million, they break it up into 5,000 pieces to say each house will contribute how much towards that loan, inclusive of interest. And onto that they would build in their administration fee, they would build in their leisure time and stuff like that. And at the end of the day, each of the 5,000 houses would be given or would be told that rent to stay in that four-roomed house was going to cost you 3 rand. Now the 3 rand had already been broken down.
Down already completely. In that.
So we didn't know. We just know that we're going to rent a house.
Absolutely.
And we didn't know that we are paying back a loan.
Correct.
Okay. Now these are the things that I learned whilst I was a councillor.
Wow. We're going to listen to some music, and when we come back, we're going to listen to a bit more about Joe's journey. And it's certainly interesting to hear, and I hope there are some councillors listening who are currently in council and can start to learn that there are people in the community that can certainly learn, that have already learned those lessons, and all you have to do is listen to them. And that's certainly what we're learning, what we're doing here. Hi, it says, good morning. How did Mr. Chivangu know when to retire from business? Because as you know, this is the Small Startup Big Dream show. We talk about entrepreneurship, and we're on Joe's journey from zero to retirement. So tell me, when did you know when to retire?
You always get indicators. With the current crop of people that are running the administration, we had our corona, if you want to call it that. And the corona there is bribery, corruption. As soon as those came in, I knew it was time for me to go.
And at what age did you retire?
2015, how old was I then?
I think only you would know the answer to that.
But I'm in retirement, I've been in retirement for the past 4 or 5 years.
5 years. And how old are you now, Joe?
On the 24th of April, I'll be 76.
So you retired after you were 70. That's pretty good innings.
Mm-hmm.
And now you haven't retired because now you're doing Bitcoin. But yeah. We'll chat about that a bit later, because you're still busy on your journey.
Oh, right.
I mean, that's just... I had another request from a reader who said, "Hello, I read that you are an activist. What did you do to help out as we are in Human Rights Month? Also, how did you feel about the changes that you fought for today?" So I think we answered that first question. He already helped out by putting two boys into his home while he was doing newspapers. And I think the only question we need to ask you is, how do you feel about the changes that you fought for today?
Frustration. Because it looks like people that are in charge have lost the cause. I would say 25, 26 years into democracy, people have started, I don't know whether it's because they've seen money at a distance, now they have to administer it. So the money has become so shiny that it goes into their pockets.
And that's quite sad, because as you say, the cause that they fought for was equality and democracy.
Exactly.
And it was building a world together. And it seems that the world together is... There was a book by George Bernard Shaw. I don't know if you know it. It's called Animal... it was called George Bernard Shaw. But it was about the animals who were living on this farm.
Or Animal Farm.
Animal Farm, that's correct. And they took over the farm.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And then before long, the pigs had moved into the house, and they decided that some animals were more equal than others.
Exactly. I've read that book, I know.
And that's pretty much
that's where we are now. That's where we are now.
And that's sad, because you went to be a counselor.
Very sad.
To make sure that people were looked after and that things were done right.
Exactly.
And to have that what was done right to now be done wrong.
Exactly. And what happened was when the new dispensation came, the first thing that happened, and that was a major blunder, and that was the indication that people were in for it for themselves. It was a question of whatever they see, whatever was there that apartheid had left, was no good. So everything had to be taken away and start afresh. Now, people that were starting afresh had no experience of what they were doing at all. Hence, what they did was to start taking the very people that were doing the job and privatize and use them as consultants. I'd sit here as if I'm running this office, and a person who used to run the office would be having a table at the corner. He would be paid a salary. He'd been paid all his money and the pension for the previous job he was doing under apartheid. Now he'll be doing the job for me.
Okay.
Since that time, I mean, our people knew nothing, so they had to learn, and most of them, to them, being in offices was status. And like I'm saying, people got into it for
all the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
And I think that wasn't a legacy that Nelson Mandela left us. His legacy was, let's take this forward together and make it work together. It wasn't really about, well, now we'll just have a reverse racism and turn it the other way around, so now we've got reverse apartheid, as opposed to saying, let's do this together, because that was the path he had chosen to take.
If we had followed that, all that had to happen was just to start merging, you know.
The old way, the new way, and make it one way.
And make it one. And there you'd be able to, you know, to break even.
And would you consider being a counselor today if you were given the opportunity?
No, I wouldn't.
So you were glad you did it when you did, because you learnt an enormous amount. Judging by what you said earlier, what you had learnt, you wouldn't have learnt anywhere else.
I wouldn't have. I learnt, and I don't regret what I learnt. And I hope and I wished that the counselors today had learnt what we learnt then. Because apartheid at the time, for themselves, it was a perfect system. And if we had taken that system and implemented it, this country would be very far.
We'd be quite far ahead.
Of course. What, just to add, what this guy Knutse had done, whilst we were in the community council. He sent, I think, some 6, if not 8 persons, I can't recall the numbers, who had matriculated. He sent them to the University of the North, Telflo, to go and study administration.
Oh my goodness.
And that got paid for by the rental money and what have you. Those people went there to learn the tricks. But when democracy came in, those very people with those certificates, because of politics, were made clerks. They were chased away. All people that were brought in for the wrong reasons. You had to be politically connected. So we lost everything.
You lost all that knowledge.
All that knowledge.
That knowledge was, and as knowledge you gained as well, and you know that they gained very similar knowledge.
Oh yes. First mistake the ANC did was to demolish the township administration offices. Took everybody who was there and crowded them at the town hall.
But that doesn't make sense because it takes them away from their people.
Precisely.
Because that person who could come and talk to their council and say, I have this problem, they now suddenly have to catch a number of taxis or go and find that person. And generally with call centres, you cannot speak to a person. You speak to a phone.
And the thing is, the councillors today, people that got in through politics, they have no clue of what administration is. And immediately they did that. They demolished the township administrative offices' income. There was no income anymore from the local people. And the local people knew that, we're no more paying rent, so why should we pay rent? Then it became the burden of the state.
So it went from being somebody who was self-sustaining to somebody who became a burden.
A burden. And even today, if you look at it, look at your television today. The president announces we are going to give a relief fund of 350. See the queues that are there. People have just become dependent because they were taught and they were told to become dependent. And when you are dependent, you are told, no, you must have your own business. When you have your business, someone who's an official there says, give me a brown envelope. Bribe me for you to get A. Bribe me to get B.
That's so sad.
That's why...
That's tragic.
That retired me.
I can imagine. So that's why you decided it was enough for me. And what did you do with your business, Joe? Is your business still going?
Before I retired, what I'm talking about was for all jobs that are government related, because government is the major employer in construction and number of things. But in my field of construction, I had my connections with the private sector. I had engine, mobile at the time.
And that's when you built garages?
That's when I built garages.
Did you remain building garages until you retired, or did you change from garages back into housing?
I did both. I would have a job to build a garage at a certain place. Have a job to build houses. I would have building society houses, or in today's terms, I would have loans that are advanced by the banks.
And tell me something, when you started as a building company, for those of you who listened last week, we talked about Joe's building company, and one of the things that I asked him was, he became part of the building community. But did they have something like the Master, I think it's called the Master Builders Association?
Yes.
I may be wrong.
Yeah, no.
But did you belong to that when you were part of it? Did they accept you being a black man before, or was it only recently that you applied?
We on our own had what we called We had our local builders association, BLAC, and we had a provincial a builders association. We called the Transvaal Builders Association, and then we had our national builders association. And together we merged with, but not merged, but we worked together with the Master Builders Association. Because from the Master Builders Association, where the you'd find a lot of those people in there were professionals, people that had degrees in being quantity surveyors, being architects, being engineers. All right. Now, some of us in the Black Builders were people that picked up the trade by experience. When I wanted to go to the tech that was nearby, and I was being paid for by my company then, was the Vaal Triangle Technicon.
So they had no issues with you becoming part of an association, yet they wouldn't allow you to go to the Technicon. That was quite interesting.
The Technicon was meant for whites. There were Technicons that were established thereafter in the homelands for black people.
Now, where would you consider, where was the homelands as such? What sort of areas were considered a homeland?
What they call Limpopo today, what they call KwaZulu Natal today, in the Free State, in the northwest, also somewhere near Mafia.
And yes, you do retire after there's a retirement after your small business. Am I right, Joe?
You're right.
And he made the decision when he saw the political landscape changing. He decided that was time for him to go, and he retired, and he now spends time with his family. And we're going to chat to him a little bit later about what he's actually doing when he's retired, because you know what, there's a thing about an entrepreneur is they're serial entrepreneurs. So Joe, let's just chat a little bit about, you were talking about scrap metal during the break. Is that also, was that one of your side hustles as well?
Yes, I did scrap metal when I started it part time when I was in construction, and because I had bought a site, and this site I was hoping to develop. I had applied to the oil companies for them to put up a garage, but because of all sorts of things, it didn't materialize. So I ended up with this site, which was now in my hands, and I asked myself, what do I do with it? And the idea came, because I have my connections. Make no mistake, as a hustler, you learn all kind of languages.
I'm sure you do.
My Afrikaans is perfect. I spoke to African-speaking people, because most of them are into scrap metals. I said, how do you do it? What is it? And when they showed me, when they opened up, I noticed, oh, scrap metal, scrap yard or scrap metal, to me, is like you saying, when you eat pork, you don't, on the table, you don't say it's pork, you say it's bacon. Yet it comes from a pig. And when you look at the pig, a pig is dirty, it's all sorts of things. That's scrap yard.
I'm not picking that.
Scrap out of those rusted tins, rusted irons, the money that comes out of there is enormous. It's, I made good money out of scrap. But the only thing is, when I went to these people that melt.
The melting company.
I said, give me what's the name?
I think it's called the Foundry.
That's right.
Yeah, Foundry.
These guys, they would play two and this, that, this. No, this is not what. Hey, you need this. Oh, until I gave up. So I had to go through a middleman. Now, when you go through a middleman makes his
his cut?
A big one for that matter. So the profit that you make at the end of the day, you make good profit, but you don't maximize. This is a problem.
Well, I think one of the things with the scrap metal yard is that you just need a yard. You need like almost a sort of a caravan to host your office, and the rest is just a yard. So it doesn't need to be perfect. It doesn't need to have somebody to measure it or put it up. It's just a pile of scrap metal. So it makes your costs far less, I'm sure.
Oh, yes. But it calls for, one, thieves. People will come and steal from you like it's going out of fashion.
And you couldn't tell if the goods they were bringing you were stolen either.
Yeah. The person will come and sell you this. In the evening, he'll jump over the fence and come and pick it up, sell it back to you tomorrow.
No! Oh my goodness!
There's nothing that you do in life where you just say you're walking in a paradise. No ways. Even the best of people who've got money will tell you having to make money is not an easy journey.
No, it's not.
You have to take risks.
The hustling, absolutely.
You take risks. You have to believe in people. And somewhere you can't do it yourself. You have the idea, but you have to use someone else. And that someone else will look and see your idea is good. And somewhere that someone else is going to reward himself, even if you reward him. So it's not an easy journey.
No, it's different. And I'm glad to see that your wife, Sheila, kept with you on this journey, because I'm sure in the morning she'd wake up and say, "So Joe, when I go to work today, what do I say you do? Do I say you're a builder? Do I say you're a scrap metal dealer? What do I tell people you do?"
To stop her from asking those questions, I said, "Start your own small business, sell uniform to the schools."
And she took that over when she finished with the newspapers.
And she took that when she finished with the newspapers.
That's amazing. So you see, she also had two kind of jobs. So you can't say you've got the corner on more than one job.
Yeah.
But Joe, in terms of the journey, would you have changed anything? Looking back, what would you have changed about your entrepreneurial journey? If you had an opportunity to have it all over again, what changes would you make?
The changes that I would wish they would happen would be the opening of doors that got shut in my face.
So, for instance, like the Technicon?
Like the Technicon story.
Yeah.
Like the foundries that was leaving me. Like when I started in construction, they'd look at the color of the skin and they say, "But do you know how to do this? You understand, you know, the technicality." These are the things that I would wish would change.
So those you would want to have different. But in terms of your journey, when you started way back then and you look back and you think, you know, I made the decision to go from here to here, i.e. into construction. You know, it's at that point I should have stayed in promotion. Because remember, you were promoting with Ipitombi. Mm-hmm. And did you ever have any regrets?
No. Everything I did. I went all out for it. I enjoyed it. I got past it.
As Frank Sinatra said, "I did it my way."
Precisely. I don't regret. Things that I did, I don't regret.
And you did it with the knowledge you had at the time.
Yeah. That limited knowledge. And I learned a lot as I progressed.
Tell me something. Did you finish school? And I'm just asking. At that time, I know schooling was limited for a lot of people, and I just wondered if your education was complete or if you managed to get through life without having completed your education.
I matriculated when I started work. I just matriculated, and then from there I started studying privately. It's not easy. For me, it wasn't very easy. I couldn't finish because my concentration was more on than my hands-on things.
And what did you study?
I studied it was personnel management at some stage, and I studied
estate agency.
But then also I look at it, you get involved to sell a house, you have to, how many houses are going to sell to make 100,000? You understand? I look at all those things and they kind of discouraged me.
And that wasn't something you wanted to pursue.
No.
Because when you do something, you want to get paid, and you want to move on to the next project.
Exactly. that's what I'm doing now with cryptocurrency. The platforms I'm involved in, you know, you have a time frame. You invest so much now, over so much, you get so much back. That's it.
So you've gone from personal trading to online trading. Ah, that's a leap of faith. Joe, at your age, I'm really blown away that you were able to make that leap of faith. So I want to know a little bit about when you made the leap of faith, how much knowledge did you have for an online product? Because you've gone from a hands-on, let me put a brick on top of a brick, to putting your hands into an online platform that you don't have much control over.
That one, I got frustrated at some stage. And at some stage I told myself, in life, up until where I am, I'm not a quitter. I never quit. When I chase something, I chase it until I am successful.
So you don't have the policy of, if at first I don't succeed, I'll try something easier?
No.
You just, if at first I don't succeed, well, damn right, I'm going to get it right eventually.
I may not do the same thing, but I'll do something, maybe something similar. Or something that's in that line, but at the end of the day, I must come.
You will absolutely, definitely get it right. We're talking about, and he was one of the first people to manage the Ipitombi crowd, and that was, they were on the top 20 in 1974. In October, they reached the Springbok top 20. I was reading a little bit about, because that was Margaret Singana.
Yeah.
And was Margaret Singana your connection?
No, I was dealing directly with her.
So just in terms of where you came from, and that's why I played Ipitombi, Mama Tembe's wedding, was because from there to now you're doing cryptocurrency. So tell us a little bit about this journey, because this is the serial entrepreneur coming out. You retired from building, you're now doing cryptocurrency. What is cryptocurrency?
if I have to put it in a nutshell, it's... cryptocurrency is the money of the future. It was designed, or shall I say, the person who founded it was a Japanese person. Now I don't, just forgotten all my details here. But that's money that we're gonna be using in the future.
In terms of cash, you mean we're no longer gonna use cash or credit cards, we're gonna use a cryptocurrency?
Cryptocurrency is what we're going to be using. This is, you know, in the form of Bitcoin. Now, this is what they've done is they've designed what they call the blockchain. And the blockchain controls all transactions that happen through the Bitcoin. Now, the Bitcoin is digital money. Like you go and you swipe your card and you get money out, you transact on your phone and you transfer money from your account to your creditor data or something. That's what we're getting into. And when the Bitcoin started, it had no value at all. It was less than 10 rand, if I had to call it that. And what we're using, you know, the pounds, the rands, the dollars, that's what we call fiat currency. Now, the Bitcoin is neither gold, neither is it paper, but it's money that you use. If I have a Bitcoin, a Bitcoin account, and you have a Bitcoin account, all that happens is we call those accounts wallets. Now, I will transfer, if I owed you, say, 20 rand, I would transfer the 10, I was then typing the 20 rand in Bitcoin. It's to be 0,0002, something like that. I'll transfer that from my wallet to your wallet, and my debt is settled. Now the good part is, as we speak, there is a Bitcoin ATM in Johannesburg, yeah. And a PIP can pay if you have a you can pay in Bitcoins.
At Pick and Pay.
Pick and Pay.
Now tell me, from a construction worker, and I use the word worker in inverted commas, to a cryptocurrency trader, that's quite a leap of faith. I mean, that's a bridge.
It is.
That's a huge bridge.
Very interesting stuff.
Was it a hard journey? In other words, was it did you lose money along the way?
I did. Oh, make no mistake, I did. And
I hope Sheila, you're listening, huh? So when he gets home, you can smack him because he hasn't told you.
I lost some money, and I made some money. That's the encouragement. Like I'm saying, there's a couple of cryptocurrency platforms that one can trade on. Bitcoin is one. Bitcoin Vault is another one. They're introducing something called Electric Cash. Now, there are plans that they sell for an X amount of money. You buy that, and then every day you get given a portion of the profits that they have that have accrued. Now, but that takes you around. In fact, the contract that you buy. You buy a contract in Bitcoin, Bitcoin Vault, Electric Cash, for a period of 1,100 days.
1,100 days.
That's right. But in the process, if you need money, you can withdraw from the, because it's your own money.
Oh, wow.
Although it's a long-term thing.
So I think what we're going to have to do, Joe, you realize that this journey with me is not over. So now that you've launched into a whole new career as an entrepreneur, you're going to have to spend another day with us. You do know that, don't you? Because we're going to have to talk about this cryptocurrency, because clearly it's a journey you've started, but now you've got me interested, because I must tell you, I was in technology for a long time. For 20 years, I was a project manager. I was around when they launched PCs, laptops, desktops. And then when Bitcoin came on, I couldn't get my head around it. I just couldn't understand how virtual money had a value. So I think it's a journey we're going to have to continue. You do know that.
I'd be glad to work it with you.
So we're going to have to tell people who are listening how cryptocurrency works, how Bitcoin works, and take them through that journey, because I've got the same problem. I don't understand it.
Yeah, a bit of crypto and the different platforms.
So I think that's an exciting journey.
Because, like I say, Bitcoin... No one thought today Bitcoin would be at 800, close to 900,000.
Yo.
No one ever dreamt of that.
So if you invested in the beginning, you're doing well.
Oh.
I'd love to talk to you about things called, they call it either a cryptocurrency farm or a Bitcoin where they have lots of computers. What do they call them? A Bitcoin farm?
Oh, yes. That is now in the what they call mining city.
Ah, oh, that's it. Yeah, it's a crypto, yeah, it's a crypto mine.
Mining,
yeah.
City. They've got a farm. It's in Poland, Warsaw. They have it there for one reason. Electricity in Poland is the cheapest in the whole world.
Oh, my word. You mean it's not a cable tied from a robot from the electricity pole to the robot?
There they have it. Look, it's, I don't know how, but the farm on which they was them is, they make their electricity right from, it's like hydro was names, but they've got all these container-like type of containers where they house all these machines that mine the Bitcoin.
Oh my goodness.
And that is where it's quite a Western, it's quite a journey.
Okay, and are you thinking, or were you planning before COVID of visiting Poland?
I'm no more fond of flying. And
oh, Joan, I bet Sheila's not happy to hear that. I mean, surely your dream of retirement was going on a cruise or flying somewhere. Or
there's things that I used to love, like traveling. I used to love that. In between my construction and what have you and what have you.
And your scrap metal and you're selling newspapers.
I used to, in South Africa, I used to travel. You ask Sheila, she doesn't regret not asking. We travel with all these, what do you call them now? I was a member of the, what do you call this now?
A Toastmaster?
No, not Toastmaster. These ones that handle wild animals. And what have you
the World Animal Association?
No.
Nature Conservation?
Listen, now I want to say...
Sandparks?
I forget, but I'll remember.
It's okay being over 70, you wild.
But you know, it's places that you go to, you go and relax there. It's
sand parks where you can visit all their parks.
Yeah.
Kruger National Park, I'm sure you've been many times.
Part of it, I've been to these ones in Natal, North Natal, South Natal, up to the Wild Coast, in the Garden Route. We've traveled quite a little.
Quite a bit.
So right now, just getting to the car and it becomes a nightmare.
I'm sure. Yeah. Well, Joe, it's been a pleasure. It's always been a pleasure to talk to you. One of the things I think we need to invite you back to talk to us about cryptocurrency and Bitcoin. So you're going to do a lot of homework. You're going to do a lot of research. Because when you come on air, you have to help people who don't know me. So you've got to bring all your documents.
I love all the scripts.
And we've certainly got space for you on a Tuesday, because a Tuesday is when we take a journey with an entrepreneur and we learn about how his product works.
Okay.
So I think you're definitely back on Tuesday. So those of you who want to listen to more of Joe, Joe's going to teach us and take us on the journey of cryptocurrency. One of the nicest things about Joe Chivangu is he's over 70. So you know what's nice? He doesn't have this young tech speak. When they speak to you, it's like, what do you mean you don't understand what I'm talking about? He gets it. He gets that older people don't always have the immediate knowledge that younger and millennials have. So I'm sure it's going to be quite a journey, Joe.
I'm sure I'm going to enjoy it.
And he was probably one of the most reluctant people on radio I have ever met. His daughter and I took a while to convince him to come on radio, and now he's a natural. So having him on air, thank you, Joe, for coming through from the Vaal and coming to chat to me and especially about your journey. And I look forward to seeing you on Tuesday.
Thank you. Tuesday, Wednesday?
No, Tuesday, because Wednesday's for Living Legends. You're no longer a legend. Okay. Now you're a crypto guy.
All right.
Now you've got to move from Living Legend to crypto guy.
Crypto. Okay.
So you've got to learn, you've got to move into the training channel.
I'll just put it in my diary according. I still run a diary.
Oh, so do I. Do you know that I can't find one? I've been to 4 stores and I cannot find a diary I can write in because I make my notes in my diary, which is quite sad.
Okay, we'll see if we can. I was lucky to get one just when they had down, when they reduced the price. You know, after February, I think, they reduced the prices. So I was lucky.
Wow, it would be so cool. And the name I think you were looking for was Flexi Club or Holiday Club?
Flexi and Holiday Club. That's what I was looking for. I've been a member since 1983, I think.
Wow.
It's been quite a while.
I'm just amazed that you found time between all your side hustles to take the family on holiday. But I bet while you were on holiday, you were hustling as well.
Oh, yes.
Finding new people, and especially now that you're doing cryptocurrency, the minute you have an opportunity to talk to somebody, the conversation goes off to cryptocurrency. Thank you, Joe Chivangu, for taking us through your journey from zero to hero.
You've been listening to Janine Preston. This has been a podcast for Life is a Beach.